Welcome to Faith Walking Conversations. In this episode, Ken Schumann and a group of faith walkers reflect on the topic of grief and loss. This conversation was originally recorded in July of 2020. We want to remind you that Faith Walking's mission is to make wholeness possible for individuals, communities, and the world. Visit us at www.faithwalking.us. Join this conversation. I'm looking through the eyes of love. I'm gonna look twice at you until I see the Christ in you.
What I'd like to talk with you about is this idea again. We spoke about it early on in this process, but I want to come at it from a little different perspective. And it's the issue of loss. But I want to come at it from a leadership perspective. So particularly over the last probably month now, we've been talking about managing anxiety. We've been talking about defining ourselves. And we've also been talking about all the issues that are going on in the world, from pandemic to racial issues to wear a mask or not, to political issues. And I think all of that kind of comes in framework when we look at it from a leadership perspective. So I'm just going to hit a couple of high notes in this handout. But the first one is, and by the way, these authors, I believe, are a couple of Harvard professors that did research on leadership. But here's the deal. Leadership is about loss. Okay, what in the world does that mean? People resist all change. Okay, so it doesn't matter who we are, we resist change. And all change involves loss. So whatever we're trying to lead, if we're leading our family, if we're leading our church, if we're leading a business, that all change involves loss, and leadership becomes dangerous when we must confront people with loss. Well, what I'm convinced of, ladies, is that there is an enormous sense of loss at multiple levels in our culture and society. Obviously, my framework is the U.S. of A., but I think the same framework applies to the U.K. In particular. And so leadership would be safe if we already know the solutions to our problems. But we don't know the solutions to our problems. And so that makes it risky because okay, just tell me where we're going, how we're going to get there, make it really easy and clear. But the kind of change that you and I are living through is deeper change than that. And we don't already have the answers. And the deeper the change, the greater the amount of new learning that's required. And the greater amount of new learning that is required, the greater amount of resistance that will come. So, it's my lens. So, in the USA, we are living in a time frame where a couple of things are happening. We're becoming far less white European descended people here. That's been going on now for about 50 years. But within the next 5 to 15, depending on where you live, white Anglo-Americans will no longer be in the majority. Well, that's a pretty significant change. And when people come who are different, what do they bring with them? They bring their culture. They bring their religion, they bring their values and their beliefs. And so In our cultures, I think, because of all of the immigration, we live in a time where old solutions just aren't going to work anymore. And as a result, everybody almost that we know is dealing with loss. Okay, so I think that's a key thing. Now, a solution for us, and by the way, because you're here, you are a leader. So when I say leaders, that means you. Leaders must promote the resourcefulness of the followers. Well, what does that mean? If you remember at the very beginning, and maybe you weren't here, so I'm going to say it again anyway. But what I believe deeply within myself is that God designed us for challenge and for adaptation. And so when the authors here speak of we've got to promote the resourcefulness of the followers, what we've got to say to people today is you can do this. You can adapt. We can change. It doesn't mean it will be worse. It might actually be better. In fact, I think it will be better. And so we have the capacity to be different. So one of the summations that the authors make is leadership requires that we disturb people at a rate that they can absorb. Disturbing people at a rate that they can absorb. I think in, like, particularly, again, my context is the U.S., so you U.K. folks can help me figure out how we apply it there. But there's an enormous amount of change, and there's enormous amount of loss. And the truth is, some people aren't absorbing it. They don't have the capacity. There's so much they can't absorb it. And so how can we help them slow down? How can we lead people in our congregations? How can we lead people in our small groups? How can we lead people at work? How can we help them let's just absorb one piece at a time. And let's think about this and that sort of thing. The final thought, and this is what really stirred me up, Deborah, is leaders are frequently amazed that people resist. But here's the deal. Habits, values, attitudes, even dysfunctional ones, are part of a person's identity. And people hold on to ideas as a way of holding on to the person who taught them the ideas. So think about first formation in faith walking language. Our first formations shaped us with beliefs and values and with stories, with history, with, oh, this is what my people were like. Oh, this is what we faced. And by the way, most all of the stories that get passed down are only the good ones. So we don't have a lot of history of the bad stuff, right? Oh, no, we only pass down the good stories. But our habits, our values, and our attitudes come from somewhere. And hear this carefully, because this is what we're faced with right now. And to abandon our habits, our values, or our attitudes means to people that I must be disloyal to their origin. Well, grandma told me that. Or, you know, grandpa told me that, or great-great-grandpa came from Germany and told us that, or came from England and told us that. People hold on to ideas as a way of holding on to that person, and some of our most deeply held values and ideas come from people we love. A relative, a favorite teacher, a mentor. Adaptive change stimulates resistance because it challenges people's habits, beliefs, and values, and even their sense of competence in the world. When I've read this book, I've reviewed this book. It's a textbook in one of my classes. But when I went back over it, it was like I saw this for totally afresh and through the lens of faith walking. So our first formation impacts our beliefs and values, and we hang on to whatever it was, whether it was good or bad, because of who we got it from. So much of the resistance is just, it's resistance to change. And it's resistance to, well, wait just a second. That means grandpa didn't tell me the whole story. Or that means my ancestors way down the road weren't as perfect as I'd hoped they were. Let me give you a real story. So one of the things I think that's really helpful is to do a family genogram and to do family of origin work. So my sister has done most of the work and I've just kind of tagged along with her, but we have a genogram and I've researched my history all the way back into the 1500s. So one of the things I'm really proud of is I am a direct descendant through my father's mother of Puritan immigrants that came to the U.S. in 1640. They established the first colony of Puritans on Long Island and established the first city on Long Island, which is South Old Long Island. Well, that sounds pretty cool, right? Well, I found out I'm a direct descendant of the guy that was the land surveyor that surveyed the property and divided it up and helped them know who owned what property and all that. So he was educated. He came from a fairly well-to-do family in England, and they were Puritan, and they came for religious freedom. Wow, all of that sounds tremendous. Well, I get to digging around and doing some history. Because I want to know, these are my ancestors. I want to know what happened and what all went on. And one of the first things I find is that the pastor of the church led them. So he led this group to immigrate from England to the U.S. to establish this new place. And one of the first laws that they established was you must agree with our doctrinal statement and be a member of our church to live in our community. Well, that sounds like nice religious freedom, right? So they came for, because there was persecution, and then guess, and then they set the walls real tight. Well, then what? Here's the horrible part of the story. So then I find that somewhere along the way in the early days, a Quaker minister came through Southold, and he got into theological discussion with the pastor of the Puritan church in Southold, Long Island, and it got heated. And so guess what the pastor did? They determined, well, this guy's, he's breaking the law, and so he needs to be punished. And so they fine him an exorbitant amount of money. They whip him with, I don't remember how many lashes on his back. And they brand an H into his forehead for heretic. And my great, 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 great grandfather was part of that group that did that. What's my point in telling you the story? I love all the really exciting parts of that story. I don't love what they did, right? And the truth is, here's what I believe. As I've done my own family of origin work and family genogram work, here's what I believe. Every family has garbage in it. We've got relatives that we're ashamed of. We've got relatives that didn't believe right, didn't act right, didn't do things right. But recognize, if we've never done that work, then our visions of our heritage are all perfect. oh, well, my ancestors were, oh, this and that. And so we hold on to that. And then as a result, what happens is we resist change when change comes, when it looks different. Well, guess what? Those Puritan immigrants from England resisted change also. I mean, here they were in a new land. They were resisting change. And so many today are challenged by a sense of loss of pride and admiration for their ancestors. And they feel a loss of their heritage. And as a result of that, they're resistant to considering anything new or different or to any kind of change. One of the things I love to teach my pastoral care students is, and what group in all the world is best equipped to help people deal with loss than ministers and people that are faithful in churches? Why? Because that's part of what we do. We help people deal with loss. Well, let's translate our understanding of helping people deal with loss into helping people deal with loss of heritage, helping people deal with loss of the way things were, that in their minds were that was this great idea, and help them realize, you know what, we're moving to a new day and a new place, and it's going to be good. So In the handout, I've listed, and there are five stages of grief that people go through. Many of you have studied those. You probably know them. In my experience, they call them the five stages of grief. But I don't think they're linear stages. Okay, I go through this one, and then oh, now it's the next one, and oh, now I think we are in and out of all of them throughout it. But let me just make a couple of comments about the stages of grief. Number one is denial. Oh, that isn't true. Oh, there's no way that happened. So here's what I believe. Conspiracy theories are a form of denial. I'm unwilling to face the truth, so I'm going to believe a conspiracy. It's got to be something other than this. And also, as long as there is denial that it's real, there will be no empathy. So one of the questions I keep asking is, why don't people have more empathy? People that claim to be followers of Jesus, here's what I'm convinced of today. They're in denial. We don't have a real problem. There's nothing to change. Let's just go back to what we've always had. Denial is the first stage of grief. Anger is the second stage of grief. Any of you faced any anger? And anger, I think, involves blaming. I've got to find someone to blame, right? So think about if I was dying, I would, okay, it's somebody's fault. I'm going to blame somebody, and maybe ultimately I'm going to blame God, but I want to blame somebody. Well, that's just part of the anger that comes out. And so one of the things that helps me is building an awareness. So what would it look like to minister to people who are angry? Well, we know they are because they're angry half the time at me, right? Or you, because of something we say or something we post or something we believe. But what if we treated them more as, okay, what would it look like to offer pastoral care to these people that are angry all the time? Because they're experiencing loss. I talk and Google on my phone pops up, and see, there it is now. It's popping up again. I mentioned her name. For me, as we look at all that's going on in the world, I think we're in and out of these two stages of denial and anger. But the third stage is bargaining, where, okay, well, maybe if I clean up my act, or maybe if I do this, and I hear this, and I want to apply it to the larger, you know, kind of our country and global scheme. And it's this idea. Well, if people would just get right with God, God would bless us and everything would be fine, right? If they'd just repent, and for me, that's a form of bargaining. No, well, maybe if everybody would do this, we could go back to what we had. And the truth is, we're not going back. And but we go through the bargaining phase, then there's a phase of depression, and then ultimately there is acceptance. And for Christians, we add a sixth one, and that is there is Christian hope. And for me, I want to call us, those of us in this room are leaders. So I'm announcing you a leader. I don't care what title you have. You're a leader. And as leaders, our hope is none of this is surprising God. None of this is catching God off guard. And God's going to lead us through it. So what does it look for, like for us to remain calm, to stand by what we believe, but recognize there are a whole lot of people dealing with loss, and they're resistant to the loss, and they don't even know they're grieving. And so they're denying, and they're blaming, and they're angry, and they're resistant. For me, it just helps get it in that perspective to say, okay, and what I want to do is help lead, which doesn't mean I help argue. I just help lead. And it also means I want to offer pastoral care to people. And so I'm asking myself this question: what does it look like to offer pastoral care to people that are angry and maybe even angry at me? So all of that's what got stirred up for me last night and this morning. Got up a little early, not too terribly early, so I still feel okay. So let me give you about 5-10 minutes to say what's on your mind, then we'll break into some small groups, okay? So what's that stir up for you? Anything in particular you'd like to speak to? Deborah?
Yeah, of course this got stirred up in me as you were talking. When we're grieving what our family passed down to us, who we believe to be true, that to me all taps into honor shame. That it's not the truth justice, the guilt innocence. It's the deep core of who we are as people of honor and shame.
Right. But
that's what I'm seeing exploding around as I see all this. It looks to me like they're dealing with belongingness. Who were my good people?
Right.
Who gave me favor, and all that is being stirred up too.
Right. Right. Yeah. And so, okay, you know what? That's a whole lot of loss. And they're resistant to it. And you know what? The truth is, I love to think that I'm this great, adaptable human being. But the truth is, I resist change a whole lot of times too, right? I like what I like, and I like being comfortable, and I don't like being challenged, and I don't like pain. Yeah. Anything else somebody wants to say or ask here in the big room? Yeah, Mark, Mags.
You can call me Mags. Yeah, everybody does. It just struck me that all of us, but those who are profusely holding on to grief because of loss, because they're not happy people.
Right.
And it made me feel sad because all the time that they are kicking against the edges of something they don't want because they want something else, they're not opening themselves to the possibilities that God has for them, that life has for them, and to experiencing good and different and purposeful life.
Right.
That made me feel sad to think about that. I've not thought about it like this before.
Yeah. Yeah. So true, Margaret. So true. And it also is a reminder to me of how little faith I have. And here's what I mean by that. Throughout biblical history, the biblical story that we have from Genesis through Revelation is, you know, it's the story of Abraham and Sarah, of God saying, I want you to get up from the place you know, and I want you to go to a place you don't know. And Abraham, just like me, says, okay, Lord, where are we going? Tell me where we're going. And what does God say? Just get up and go. And I'll tell you when you arrive. Well, that takes an enormous amount of faith. And I know in me, and so I have to assume it's true for a lot of other folks, we've not cultivated that level of faith. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, wow, okay. And so I think as a Christian community, one of our challenges is, how can we help people deepen their faith? How can I deepen my faith so that I'm willing to go even when I don't even know where I'm going? I just load all the stuff up in the U-Haul and we just start driving down the highway. You know, I mean, that's literally how I hear that story. I load it all up and we head off. Well, which direction are we going to head? Are we going north, south, east, or west? Well, anyway.
And what it stirred up for me was, well, I was kind of convicted. I don't know, convicted is probably not the right word, but just made aware of the fact that I feel like even after doing what I thought was a lot of family of origin work back when I was in my graduate program for counseling, like it was ad nauseum. And then I've done, you know, some with faith walking, but I realized I'm just not in touch with that for me with change. But what I am in touch with is probably one step removed, is more the culture of my whole community as a whole, especially, you know, growing up like very conservative evangelical, you know, that whole thing. And for me, as I've gone in some different directions in recent years, just the sense of disorientation, and fear, and not knowing what does this say about me? And am I still a Christian? Like, you know, the security of those things that we believed so easily have been pulled out. Yeah. And have a new thing to hold on to yet. I'm saying those of us who, many of us have gone through this kind of thing. And there's just this long period, maybe indefinite at this point. I don't know what it is, but like, I'm just, you know, you're between, you know, kind of.
Yeah. As Deborah wrote about, it's liminal space. Yeah, I get it, Angela. And I want to encourage you particularly because I have been on that journey. And I think it involves three phases. It involves deconstruction first. And then after I deconstruct, there's a period of nothing. And some people get stuck at nothing. But if you keep pressing forward after nothing, there's construction. And construction is, okay, I know what I don't believe. Now, what do I believe? And in my journey, it was almost every piece of belief, one at a time, saying, what do I believe about this? Okay, and what do I believe about that? And some of those things I've gotten fairly clear about and could say to you, this is what I believe. There's some other ones that I'm still working on. And so it's all a journey, I think, but I do think, and I don't know how long the nothingness lasts, but after nothingness comes construction. So let's don't chase that rabbit. I want y'all all to have a chance to talk. Let's go to the small groups, if you would. Anything out of your small group you want to talk about, report, any questions emerging, think something you want to say?
Ken, I have two things to say. They're both quick, but One is from our small group and one is from what you said about your family history. And I wouldn't have brought this up, but we had quite the historical discussion in our small group. And it wasn't by me. I'm a history person. Your great, 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 the guy who surveyed all the land.
Yeah.
You do know that that was all Native American land he was surveying, right?
I do know that. I do. They, in the history record, they supposedly paid for it.
Well, what comes next? Are you familiar with King Philip's War?
No.
That's going to be about 35 years later, 1675. Okay. It's considered the first war on American soil, and it's right in that area where your ancestors were. And it's awful. It's an awful, awful story, but you might want to look into that too. As long as
he's like, thanks, have a good weekend.
You just want to destroy my image completely, don't you? You just completely want to annihilate my whole
family history.
Yeah.
He wants to give you more reason to be ashamed.
Exactly.
Thanks, Tammy. You're awesome.
No, I love it. Thank you, Tammy. What else?
Learning to manage our anxiety in the midst of redefining ourselves is what you teach us. Mm-hmm. I love you, man. Love you. Mag said something that is just going to stick with me. I'm going to put this on my wall here. She said, behind all anger, there is a story to be told.
Mm. Yeah.
I love that.
Isn't that a great... Wow. Yeah. Write that in the chat, somebody.
That's a hip pause and learn to listen and calmly listen to what is going on. It's just so succinctly and beautifully put. I'm really grateful. Margaret, for saying it.
Who said
behind
that, Mag?
All anger, there's a story to be told.
Yeah, I just try and make myself aware that when people behave what we would consider outside social boundaries, it's usually a defense,
right?
Of what's gone on in their life before, and not just to look at the cover and think you know the book.
Yeah, right.
But you'll be blessed. I've had to write my own words down because I'd forgotten what I'd said. Thank you so much, Tammy.
I wrote it down right away. It was beautiful.
She's a history major. She thinks she remembers.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it when somebody records something that I said that I wanted to keep because I forgot to record it. What else? Good. Thank you for sharing that. Judith?
Nope,
you're unmuted. Nope. Okay.
Nope. I'm good.
All right.
Tammy took care of it.
I do appreciate your helping me to consider the angle of grief around loss of identity, because I was thinking of all my friends who are so upset about the statues coming down and Confederacy and I hadn't really, because I don't identify heavily with that, even though I'm from the South, but obviously a lot of people do, so I appreciate that because it helps me not be so judgmental and a harsh critic. So
I hear you, Leslie.
Yeah,
I mean it's the same sort of thing with the Aunt Jemima brand.
Yeah.
Of okay, no, my people weren't racist. We, Grandma served Aunt Jemima pancakes, and it's the history that goes with that, and and so I'm not even open to listening to what. Okay, why is that significant?
Right.
Yeah, it's just. These are unusual times, are they not?
Mm-hmm.
Unusual and powerful, and they really can propel us into a better future.
Yeah, I'm absolutely convinced, folks, that we're in a normal every 500 year or so period of change, and we're in the midst of it, and. We may not be able to tell the stories, but there are going to be people telling stories about this time and about us. At some point, the wonderful historians are going to talk about, and here was one of the things that accelerated the change was this pandemic that occurred in 2020. And systems started to fall and change started to happen. And there was a whole lot of resistance to that change as it happened. And folks were anxious and they weren't behaving very well.
Yeah.
But there was this amazing group of faith walkers who met every Friday via Zoom, and they changed the world.
Yeah. and they recruited more people who also changed the world.
Amen and amen. Let it be so.
That's right. It slowly spread like yeast.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the whole lump of bread. Powerful stuff, though. Powerful stuff.
Yeah, it is.
Hey, Ken, do you think we're on the in the middle of the change or kind of just in the beginning stages of it?
Well, I don't know how long it's going to last, Deborah, and trust me. So I'm just flying off the cuff. I'm not a historian. I want to make that clear since we have a historian in our presence. Here's what I think. I think the change began in the 60s. I think that was the beginning of the change. And so how long is it going to last? I don't know. But so for me, it feels like maybe the middle. But I don't know because I don't know. I mean, who knows? Maybe something, all of this will accelerate it so fast that, you know, that, okay, and in 10 years, you know, it's kind of made the transition. I don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to probably last for, you know, 25, 30 more years at least as we transition toward it. So that's why I say maybe middle of it.
Do you think it's more of a change in just like the Western societies?
Well, I think Western society, again, I'm talking out of my league, Courtney. I think primarily the West. I think it's primarily the West, but I think the West impacts the rest of the world. So I think it, but the huge shift is primarily Western, in my belief. Anybody with real knowledge, please weigh in because I'm an amateur at this. Yeah, Deborah.
Yeah, what we would call the Muslim world has been in some rapid change as well. And some things were put in place around World War I, again after World War II, when Israel mm-hmm. was given the land and the UK backed out. But there is rapid change in the Eastern thinking world. They're going through massive change in Islam.
Right.
Massive, massive change.
And the little bit I know also, fundamentalism in any realm looks the same.
Yeah.
So it's not about the same issues, but fundamentalism is always a resistance to whatever.
I think the other thing, Ken, as well, is that we've had the rise of postmodernism as well, where there is no right, there is no wrong. We've got pluralism, all that sort of thing coming out. So what is right in your world is completely wrong in somebody else's. So people say, well, why are people doing this? Why are people destroying this? Why have people got such and such an attitude? And people have this perception that something is wrong to do, but where are they getting these? Who's to say that that is right? Who's to say that that is wrong? That is often the perception of many. And of course, if you're moving away from a Judeo-Christian worldview with the basis in moral law, you've got chaos.
Right. Right. One piece that I would add, and then I'm going to have to go because I have a faith walking group that starts in 8 minutes. And now I lost my thought. What was I going to say?
Post-truth, modern.
It was out of the conversation that John was just talking about, postmodernism.
No absolute truth. Anything about that?
Yeah. It's not ringing. Boy, I hate getting old. I hate it.
It was what's true in your world is wrong in somebody else's.
Right.
Would that be it?
Yeah, it was something related to all that. And man, it was a really good thought, too.
Oh.
Yeah.
If you remember, tell us later on. Send us an email.
I will. It'll pop into my head. Sorry about that. Hey, thank y'all for being here. I love this group. And thank y'all for being here, even on a so-called holiday in the U.S.
For more information about faith walking, visit www.faithwalking.us. We want to remind you that faith walking exists because of your financial support. Please consider giving at faithwalking.us/donate. Thank you for listening. Until I see the Christ in you, till I'm looking through the eyes of love, till I'm looking through the eyes.